Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up. Kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Ko Speak Up Kōrerotia tēnei. This is Sally Carlton. I'm really excited to be doing an environmental-focused topic today. We're going to be thinking about bees. Just to set the scene a wee bit, here are some facts about bees and apiculture. There's thousands of subspecies of bees around the world, and we believe that bees have existed on Earth for at least 30 million years. Bees pollinate approximately one-third of food that humans eat, and that means that they're absolutely critical for biodiversity and food security. As well as the food, they're also important for other products, beeswax, bee venom, obviously honey. But tragically, we're seeing bee numbers declining globally. Now, you might be wondering why bees on a human rights show? Fair enough question. But actually, if we think about it, the protection of bees, particularly in their role as pollinators, aligns with the right to food, the right to health, the right to environment. Beyond that, though, we also see bees as being critically, culturally, and spiritually for different groups. Think about the economic considerations. Beekeeping as a source of income and livelihood. Pollination as being critical to the agricultural sector. And also as a means of recreation and mental health, looking after bees as a hobby. So in fact, there are many ways in which bees and the welfare of bees are really important to discussions on human rights. Just a few months ago, a couple of municipalities in Peru granted legal rights to bees. Also something that's sort of a world first and something that we might not think about, bees having legal rights. But this has then kind of sparked all this thinking about, well, what do we think about the environment and rights and how might this all work together? The legal rights for bees means that bees have rights to exist. They have rights to flourish in a healthy environment. And they also have the rights to legal representation in court if they're threatened. So this is all really interesting and sort of the starting point or the jumping off point for today's kōrero. Just one way of increasing awareness of bees and bee welfare. We've got three guests. You each come from different areas, I suppose, in the bee world. Dara Dimitriev from the University of Waikato. You wear lots of different hats, though, I think. Sarah Cross and Dean Andrews. I'm super excited. I'd really love to hear about you guys and how is it you got into the world of bees?
Should I start? How did I get into the world of bees? Well, actually, my family have got a long history of beekeeping. And when I was staying in Sunagora with my son, I had to catch swarms. From the first swarm catch, I was addicted. I mean, my gosh. That's how I started out in bees.
Yeah. For the uninitiated, Dara, what is a swarm and what is a swarm catch?
Swarms are the natural way that bees replicate. So women have babies, cows have calves, bees swarm. They only swarm for a short window in the season, spring, maybe a little bit later in spring if it's a wet spring, but basically there's a 6 to 8 week window where hives will start building queen cells. And as soon as the virgin queen hatches, the old queen will leave the hive with about 40% of the bees in that hive, but only healthy bees swarm. And I was staying with my uncle. He had about 3,000 hives. He was a queen bee rearer. And he had to go into Tetograd. And he said to me, if the bees swarm, grab them. And I've got pictures, Sarah and Dean, so don't you dare say I didn't do it. In Sunagora, they rub the inside of the box with a herb, which I now realise is lemongrass. and you rub the inside of the box, you crush it against your hands and you spin it around and you whistle and the queen comes to you. And I would never have believed it, but I did it. And the queen definitely comes to your hand and then you just shake them in the box. I've got pictures, so don't
you? I was going to say, I would like to see that, the whistling.
Yeah, they actually come. I've never seen such a thing. It's a very traditional Slavonic way of beekeeping.
Thank you. And Dara, in your life beyond bees?
I am currently a law lecturer at the University of Waikato. I teach a whole wide range of papers, everything from employment law to you name it, I teach it. As part of my research, I look particularly at the legal issues around apiculture, and I find it fascinating, actually. And there's a lot to write about. And so this topic today, I was saying to Dean earlier, I've started to have a hunt around. There is actually no welfare code in New Zealand, which is interesting because we like to think of ourselves as being highly evolved in terms of society, but we're clearly not that evolved.
And maybe just to point out for the listeners that apiculture is the culture of beekeeping or the act of beekeeping.
So api comes from the Latin word. It's api is the Latin word. So apiarist is a beekeeper. An apiary is where we keep our bees, and apiculture is the study of bees. You could tell I'm a teacher. I'm so sorry.
I really enjoy etymology, so good on you.
Yes.
Okay, and Sarah and Dean, it's lovely to hear from one of you.
My foray into beekeeping is the extreme other version, other scale of Dara's. It's funny that you just said, Sally, that you said etymology. Did you say et or ento?
Et.
Yeah, see, because I am an entomologist, which is the scientific study of insects. So I was never into bees. I was just into bugs in general. And so I went to university at Waikato and gained a Bachelor of Science, very specifically looking at all the little stuff and the genetics behind them and how our little bugs got to where they were. And then I worked at quite a few entomology jobs around Aotearoa and then came back to the Waikato and applied for a job at Plant and Food Research. I'd never opened a beehive in my life, and I applied for the apiary manager job. So like Dara said, apiary is where the hives are. So I literally applied for a job to look after them. I'd never opened a beehive in my life. So those weirdos gave me that job. And so my start into beekeeping was, congratulations, you are now the apiary manager. Here's 200 beehives to look after. My foray was very, very different. But a bit like Dara, as soon as you open a hive and go, oh my gosh, and just be blown away by how amazing they are. Yeah, so I actually worked for nearly a decade in the apiculture science industry. So very much talking about the welfare of bees. Not going to lie, I have killed thousands. You don't have to sign a form or get their permission or even explain what you're doing. You can kill whole hives and there's no backlash, there's no background. So I quite like that we're bringing this up because sadly I'm one of the people that has done these horrible things.
Where I'm coming from is I'm actually a farming background, farming for years, sold the farms, was looking for something to do. Did the bee course. We had a particularly big swarm year that year and suddenly went from purchasing one or two hives to having a hell of a lot more. Baptism of fire in my case. I'm now running a small business, Bee Haven, where we look after some hives and put hives on people's properties if they want them, as well as working with Dara a little bit, doing a bit of queen rearing and what have you as well.
Dean, could you explain what you mean by queen rearing?
With the queen rearing, we actually make a hive queenless for a short period. Then we grab a whole lot of eggs out of a bee frame, put them into little cups, put them into that queenless hive. They then set to work quickly to rebuild a queen for themselves. And then before those queens hatch, you pull them out, put them into an incubator so as you don't lose them because the first one out will kill all its opposition, which you don't want. And then you can spread those either through your hives, requeening them, or sell them to people that hives have become queenless or that they're wanting to update their queen because it's got too old.
So interesting thing about the queen bee rearing and what Dean was talking about is that, so Sarah and I teach beekeeping, level 3 and level 4, but there is no level 4 queen bee rearing course in the country at the moment. And none of the tertiary sector is willing to undertake it, despite the fact that we have a shortage of beekeepers and a shortage of queen bee rearers.
And what does that mean, having a shortage in terms of the bee population?
We have had a substantial drop in the number of hives since 2020. I think we had close to 1 million at that time, 960,000, 980,000, something like that. At the moment, they are saying on the website that there's, I think they say 480,000, Sarah, is that correct?
I was going to say about 500.
In my view, I think that's a very exuberant number. I think in reality, it's probably somewhere around 400,000 because there's a whole lot of hives that are weak that won't come out of winter with strong queens. So I'm guessing, in my view, that we will come out of winter with a lot less hives. And I think Sarah can talk to that around the sudden hive death problem that we're all having.
The sad thing is when a lot of our beekeepers sort of lose money or things go a bit awry for any sort of reason, the really sad thing is that a lot of them will just abandon their beehives. You see them out in the paddock, what Dara said, that's called an apiary where we keep our hives. If they've suddenly gone bankrupt or run out of money or something, even health-wise, anything happens, sometimes the first thing that goes is just they don't have the people to look after the bees and they will abandon them. So again, talking about the welfare thing, again, in the numbers and stuff, a lot of these bees coming out, no one has looked after them for the last 2, 3, 4 months. So of course they're going to perish and get cold and die. And yet there's no welfare around that to say, hey, you should have looked after them. You should have done this. You should have done that. There's no laws about it. So yeah, I agree with that, Dara, that I think the numbers are going to go even less. Even like I say, the people like us who are looking after our bees, it seems that I'm going to blame the weather, but something seems to have gone wrong and a lot of our bees are perishing for semi-unknown reasons. We might like to make educated guesses, but yeah, this has been a really bad season for most of us.
Wasps can be a big reason too why you lose hives. I've lost several this year due to wasp attacks and treating for wasps and that sort of thing. If you know where there's a wasp nest somewhere, let somebody know and we can either come and help you get rid of it, or there's lots of pest people that will happily come and destroy them for you because they give the bees a real hard time.
And I think that's not just honeybee hives and not just managed hives. I think that people don't realise that wasps are a problem for our native flora and fauna. The numbers are exploding. I think we've got what we would call a relatively warm winter. Dean and I have been out to apiaries in the last 2 weeks where we have had an apiary that didn't have a wasp problem in the past. It's just a nightmare. I mean, out at Whara Whara, I had 12 nukes. I have no nukes now. I do the butterfly net and fling them into a bucket full of no wasp powder. And the theory is that they will fly home and then they will take the powder with them and kill the nest. Butterfly net. We were catching 10 to 15 wasps at a time in the net. That's just unprecedented. We've never seen numbers of wasps like this before. It's a huge problem.
In the same way, I've got a wasp trap set up at the workshop that has been there for 3 months, had a few in it, nothing much. Sunday, I'm down there at about 9, 10 o'clock, and there wasn't much happening. Came back about 3 o'clock, and the whole thing was just full. You couldn't see through it. There were so many wasps. It was just a total explosion. It was unbelievable. and it's been the same every day for the last 3 days.
That's frightening. And I think that really says something about the welfare of the bees. It's also the welfare of our native birds, because wasps attack the babies.
And taking all of the food away from all of the other creatures that are... Yeah, so remember, our wasps here are introduced. They were brought in. So us talking about the wasps killing the beehives, that really only happens when they've run out of their other food source. Trying to get into our hives is not their first port of call. I'm only mentioning that because I don't know if you've seen the stuff up in Auckland about the hornet incursion that everyone's worried about. The scary thing about those hornets is that bees are one of their first food sources. So they would rather eat bees than anything else. Our Germans and our... what we call our common wasps here that we're talking about, they only try and hit our beehives sort of in the autumn when they've run out of food. But that food source is also, they're trying to get the nectar. So believe it or not, wasp adults are not actually meat eaters. They are nectar feeders. They drink syrup, but they take all of the dead bees and the dead caterpillars and things and take them back to their babies. But when there's no babies to feed, they are just trying to get nectar. So they're breaking into our beehives to steal their honey to eat. And so that, again, in all the flowers is also the nectar, which is also for the bees and all the native bees and the tui. And do you know what I mean? It's all competition. And these little wasps are really the bane of our existence when they get to such high numbers. Like Dara said, they can wipe out a whole entire apiary if those numbers get so high. It's just a continuous onslaught. It's horrible to watch. And we say, it's natural, but it's like, really? The wasps aren't really supposed to be here.
So as well as sort of invasive other insects, wasps and hornets, that's presumably not the only reason the number of hives have dropped 50%-ish in the last 5 or so years.
No. The major cause of death in, well, the world for our honeybees is actually the Varroa mite, which is a little mite, a little parasitic mite that feeds and breeds on larvae. So they're little baby versions of our bees when they're still in larval and pupal form. So they're all inside the hive as little grubs. And those little parasitic mites are literally sucking the life out of them. When we talk about bees, the funny thing is we don't really talk about individual bees. It's the whole colony together. It's a super organism, it's what it's called. And so it's all got what's called a collective sort of hive stomach. So as soon as you start weakening one part of it, like one, you know, if the larvae are getting sort of eaten by the little varroa mites and becoming weakened, it weakens the whole colony. And so that also can let in all the other pests and diseases that are here in Aotearoa as well. So it's like a downward kind of spiral. And again, the same as the wasps. I've got, you know, hives here. All the wasps are straight away going to my little hive. What Dara said is a nuke, so it's like a little mini hive. So because a mini hive has got less bee numbers to be able to defend, they're straight away going to the weakest one. So as soon as something starts to become weaker, all those other pests and diseases and wasps and other things can come in. So I would still say that Varroa is our number one, but we've still got loads of other pests and diseases that naturally occur with bees and beehives. You have to remember that beekeeping is farming. And like our normal dairy farming, it's all about the weather. So I again think that the wasp problem might be a weather problem, you know, like it's obviously something's just totally benefited the wasps in this last little bit, same as some of the other diseases that are hitting us at the moment. Neisseria, it's a gut bacteria. I think it's one of the things that's been killing a lot of our hives this year, and that is usually related to the weather as well. Sometimes we can't help it, we try so hard, but sometimes it's just weather related. But Varroa is definitely our number one killer of beehives in the world. Actually,
there's a lot of rain, all the pollen gets washed off the flowers and the plants. So your bees, when they go out to pollinate, they're actually not able to take that back to the hive for feeding their young. So you've actually got to artificially feed them pollen patties at certain times of the year, if it's very wet, to help the hive keep its strength.
I think I agree with Dean. The weather has been wet. There's not a lot of flowering going on at this time of the year anyway. Our native trees are probably one of the sole sources of food because some of them are still flowering. But Sarah, I was talking to somebody from the South Island last night, and he was saying that the miticide strips now, the production of the miticide strips means that the efficacy of those strips is not as efficient as it used to be. Commercial beekeepers are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on strips and they're not working. But worse than that, because the strips are not working, the queens are picking up viruses and not lasting as long.
So just to clarify, Sally, a miticide strip is a plastic strip that we put into the beehive, and it's impregnated with a miticide to kill the varroa mites. So it doesn't hurt the bees, but it kills the mites. Here in Aotearoa, a varroa came in the year 2000, and Plant and Food, where I worked, did all of the background varroa work on getting the strips into New Zealand and getting them registered and stuff. When they tested it, they only needed a tiny little bit of this chemical, of this plastic strip, to kill all the mites in a jar. And now we put in four big strips, you know, a huge amount more, and they seem to be doing nothing. I haven't seen the data of them still saying that the efficacy is still the same, but all of those tests that we did were 26 years ago. And so because mites breed so quickly, if you know about breeding and genetics and passing on the genes and things like that, that is a lot. There's a lot of babies bred and a lot of mutations that could come through and a lot of resistance that could very easily come through. And because we humans sometimes do silly things and we sometimes do not follow the instructions properly and do the things that we're supposed to do. Varroa resistance, as in mites that are resistant to the chemical, everyone is talking about it. I can't personally say it's there because I haven't looked into it, the science behind it, and I hope someone's doing it. But we all know that they're not working. And we know that because there's so many very cool scientists here in Aotearoa and around the world that are going into loads of other different avenues to try and assist our bees against the varroa, including some very cool stuff that Phil Lester has done with the RNA of the varroa to try and alter their reproductive cycle to stop them reproducing. There's other scientists doing very cool stuff in the background about different chemicals to keep the varroa down. And there's loads of organics now on the market because we've just got to find something to try and keep them down. And I've even had that myself. I had two hives right next door to each other in the same property, treated them all the same. One hive absolutely thriving, one hive completely dead from varroa. And you sort of think, what is going on here? So like talking about the queen rearing as well, is it a genetic thing? Do we need to be really keyed up on getting those genes that are good and that are, you know, keeping the varroa down, breeding those ones, things like that. So beekeeping is not as simple as some people think it is. There's always loads and loads of stuff of us working in the background trying to help our bees to survive and get through.
I think something that needs to be aware too, that when you're using your strips, it says take them out after 6 weeks or whatever. You actually take them out because the number of hives I go into, and we put strips in it about 3 or 4 months ago, we haven't bothered removing them. They actually deplete over time, and because they get smaller and smaller doses, that helps to varroa mite to build resistance to it, because it's the same as a lot of these things where it's you give a little bit of a problem to them and they suddenly become no longer a problem to them.
And that's the thing. So saying about human error, I think some of us are accidentally actually breeding super varroa because we've put the strips in, we've killed all the slightly weaker varroa, those stronger ones have stayed behind, and then we've given them that little resistance, like breeding super bugs in the hospitals. We don't mean to, but that's the thing. A lot of people don't realise that not following the rules properly or not doing things properly are causing our own harm, our own demise and our bees. Yeah, it's a bit of a scary time.
Yeah, and I would say that it's not just New Zealand that's suffering this. Bees are declining globally. In Australia, they've now got varroa mite and they're not doing well. I think one of the biggest exports from New Zealand is live bees. We've been exporting live bees. I wonder how the exports are looking. What do you guys think?
Lorimers export thousands to Canada, but they did phenomenally less. But it wasn't actually to do with knowing if the bees were resistant or dying or are. It was because, talking about the weather, Canada had a really, really long winter. So usually when they would put the orders in, it's because they'd already opened their hives, seen what their hives had done, knowing how many bees they needed. They couldn't even get into them to open them to then order the bees. And this whole time frame of getting them from us to them is a very short window of you know, when we've got the bees to give them. And the window was too short and they did phenomenally less.
I think that brings another interesting one, though. If the exports have been down and our numbers are still going down, it says how bad our bee situation is here in New Zealand. Because if we're not exporting them, they've got to be staying here.
I think they were only exporting the bees after the honey supers had come off, and those beehives would have a drop in the number of bees going into winter anyway. So that was a way of commercialising or monetising bees that would have come to a natural end anyway, I think. My cousins, they live over in Cernogorda in Montenegro. There was an outbreak of dengue fever, and then there was an outbreak of all sorts of things going on in the Mediterranean. And unbeknownst to a lot of beekeepers, they sprayed for mosquitoes and it killed their hives. I think the European Union leads the charge against chemicals and the impact it has on beehives. Neonicotinoids are banned in lots of European countries. I think we still have them here, but they're able to show that some of the agricultural chemicals actually do have an adverse effect on beehives. There is a PhD down in Otago looking at one particular chemical that is used widely in agriculture. Her data is in, and she was able to show from the time that they sprayed to the time they harvested the honey, it was through the whole hive.
That's the superorganism. They share everything. So just because the foragers have collected it, it's going to come in every single bee and every single baby, and it's all, it goes everywhere.
The chemical was through the wax, the honey. It was found throughout the hive, and I found that quite frightening. If you're semi-commercial, which most of us are, our hives are on farms. Farmers want us to have the bees there. And we always think, oh no, we're environmentally friendly. You know, we're taking the best care of our bees, but they're still spraying.
We used to farm on 300 hectares and we were dairy farming. We had just a couple of goats that roamed the whole farm. They used to nip all those young gorse, all the young blackberry, get rid of it, jump the drains, clean all the rubbish between the fence and the drain that you couldn't get to because you're fencing to keep stock out of waterways. And that reduced our spray bill hugely. If people are going to be spraying and they have a little bit of warning, if they let the beekeepers know, they can make a call as to whether they close the hive off for a day so the bees can't get out, or whether they say, no, that's far enough away, it's not going to be a problem, that sort of thing. But sprays can be a real issue, and you can reduce them quite easily and get money back in your pocket instead of giving it to the chemical companies.
The bit that worries me is that we see the bees that have died because we're looking after them. What about the thousands upon thousands of other critters and little bugs and native bees and native everything that's in the world that's also dying, and we just can't see it? Like, everything in the world is connected, biodiversity and all that, but no one seems to care because we can't see them.
Yeah, we've spoken a lot about the threats to bees, chemicals, disease, changing weather patterns, all sorts of stuff. Bringing the conversation sort of beyond the threats now and thinking more about, why do we need these bees? What do they do for Aotearoa, for our food, beyond New Zealand as well?
I think one of the biggest positive things that we have, and I can't say it's growing numbers because I think the numbers are static or even falling, is hobbyist beekeepers. I think hobbyist beekeepers are probably going to be the fallback and the way of moving bees forward in New Zealand. I can't see any other way. As Sarah was saying, the cost to keep bees is expensive. It's not cheap. You don't get economies of scale by having 50, trust me. If they need to be treated for varroa mite, every single hive has to be treated. There's a miserable reduction for buying 10 boxes or 100 boxes or whatever. I think moving forward, it's the hobbyist beekeepers that are going to play a much bigger role in improving bee numbers. I really believe that.
And that the whole reason we're talking about bees and why they're even in New Zealand is for pollination. So they were brought in on ships for pollination of the new crop, which obviously needed bees to pollinate them, because of course the native New Zealand insects were not evolved and did not know how to pollinate these English crops that they were bringing in. So that is their number one main role for the entire world, is pollination of crops. Now there are millions of insects that pollinate. It's not just honeybees, but the way that honeybees live, you know, they live in those boxes, and we humans can move them around, which is the whole point of why they are the number one insects that we use for pollination. They're not the best. There are actually, bumblebees are actually better at pollination of some plants, but honeybees, because they're in this box, we can move them around, put them where they need to be. Talking about our hive numbers going down, people are already, it's not even spring yet, and they're already stressing about not getting enough hives in to pollinate their crops. Back when I was at Plant and Food, a huge amount of our work was working with our big food crop businesses of how to not only just get the fruit or the food pollinated, but can we make it bigger, more seeds, more pollination? So it's all about making everything bigger and better and juicier and all that jazz, which is great. But if you can't even get the bees in to have those bees to move it around, you're not going to get food crops. It's as simple as that. So that's their number one, why we need them. And around the world, it's about bulk, the massive, what do they call them, monocultures, and bringing all those bees in a very unnatural environment. Again, welfare. We literally force the bees to pollinate these crops. When you bring them into a monoculture, and I'm thinking of Australia and America, which is just, the monocultures are just, you can't even imagine how huge they are. And then plonking bees in the middle of there and forcing them to eat only one crop, one type of flower, of nectar and pollen, and then expecting them to be okay with that is a massive welfare drama. Our little old New Zealand, our crops, we're just tiny, Aotearoa, we're just teensy, so we don't really have those massive monocultures like overseas, but that should be a definite welfare problem.
Something I think of interest there too, beehives in cities or in towns are great because all your flower gardens and what have you, you actually get a lot better flowers if they're well pollinated, and there's a lot of people with really nice gardens who have got one or two hives somewhere in the garden solely for the fact of wanting to have their gardens looking really sharp over summer, lots of flowers, and just helping them pop. So,
but that's also, that's good for the bees. That's the opposite of monoculture. They've got all the choice and they can fly. Even in tiny, you know, if you've got a couple of hives in your backyard, bees can easily fly 2, 3, 4 kilometres out to find food. And so if you think about urban Hamilton, that is such choice. So many different flowers and different things that they can feed on. That is so much better for the bees than that monoculture and forcing them to, you know, feed on one thing. Yeah, definitely our little hive in urban areas do better in terms of health and honey crops, except if you're going a bit commercial, you can't really put 60 hives in your urban Hamilton backyard.
Urban beekeeping, there's been a lot of change in council bylaws. So places like New York had them banned for more than 2 or 3 generations, but the beekeepers were keeping their bees there anyway. So they were like saying, nope, we cannot have bees. And then every now and then you'd get a picture of a bee swarm hanging on a bus sign in Madison Avenue, and the best honey in the world come from London, Paris, New York, and their cities. And so urban beekeepers play a really, really important role. When you think about when they introduced bees into New Zealand, I think the official number is 1839, and Busby, Mary Busby. I don't believe that for a hot second, because I think that Australia had bees well before then, and a lot of beehives that came to New Zealand came from Australia. And so I think there were bees here before then, because if you look at some of the Māori tribes, they have been beekeepers for generations. So Tūhoe have got beekeepers that have been there for generations. If you go to Great Barrier Island, they have been beekeepers for generations. I think that urban beekeeping and smaller beekeepers are probably the way forward. The numbers are not out yet, but I think Dean and Sarah will probably agree. I think we had probably one of the worst, shittiest bee seasons this last season ever. The commercial guys I was talking to yesterday, they were basically saying the queens were failing within 6 months. If you don't understand beekeeping, understand this: a hive without a queen is a bunch of homeless bees. It cannot survive. And so if you've even got 1,000 hives and 30% of them fail, you need 300 queens. There is no queen bee rearing course run in this country at the moment. But don't you worry, Dean and I are on that. So, yeah, I think urban beekeepers are the way forward. It's a recreational thing. In England, they use it for mental health issues for immigrants, particularly.
When, like, you're talking about a beekeeper who's got 1,000 hives and they lose 30%. To them, they're commercial. They're like, oh, well, you know, we can split and keep going. If you're a hobbyist and you've only got 2 hives and one dies, or even, lo and behold, both of them die, very emotional. They're their pets. We go out there and we watch them every day. These are our pets. And so a lot of my beekeepers just don't want to, their hives have died and they don't want to start again. It's too emotional. So we get very, very attached to our bees.
I think Indigenous beekeepers are really, really important. I lived in Africa for a long time. I watched how they kept bees in East Africa. And you can learn so much from them by the way that they treat them. I always argue our Māori beekeepers, they were the first commercial beekeepers. The colonisers were arriving here and the only way they could buy honey was to buy it from the Māori.
They were also the first scientists to know some honey killed you, made you sick.
Māori already knew Tutan was a problem. And then one of the brothers had seizures and one of the local Māori guys recognised the symptoms and said,
wow,
he has been eating Tutan. But don't you worry, if you go and look it up on Papers Past, they had a medical conference and when they said, we believe that it's probably the honey, some preps stood up and said, nope,
oh,
honey is medicinal, it can't possibly harm you. But it's something unique to New Zealand. We have the tutu plant in New Zealand. The bees go to the tutu at certain times of the year, normally when it's hot and dry. And there's an exudate that is found on the tutu plant because the little, those little lacy winged insects, passion vine hoppers, and the bees will collect that exudate. It's actually fine for the bees. Toxic for humans. So we do have to test our honey to make sure it's not going to cause you harm. So if you're going to sell honey in New Zealand, you have to actually test. Yeah, Indigenous beekeepers have probably got some insights that they could definitely share with us. There's quite a few research going on as well around where we should be putting our hives too.
Given this is a human rights radio show, I'd love to hear from you guys. What are your perspectives on how this world of bees, this world of insects, connects into human rights?
I think one thing's worth noting is I'm noticing with some people who are doing subdivisions and what have you, they're putting in their subdivision things, no bees for the subdivision. I see that as major problems going forward.
I mean, I know that talking about the bylaws that Dara said, they've changed the bylaws.
Actually being written into some of the sales agreements, yes, no bees.
Don't like that at all.
I think that there is an obligation on us as beekeepers to have a code of conduct. I was a bit shocked to learn that we actually don't have an official code of conduct. I think Apiculture New Zealand, before they became this, they used to have something. I remember reading it years ago, but that's disappeared off their website. And I know that the New Zealand Bee Incorporated, they have a code of conduct, but it's a really big gap because I think Sarah is right. There's no obligation upon people to give any consideration to bees and the welfare of bees. And so when you come on to our level 3 courses, one of the key things we teach is to learn the nature of bees, to learn how to work with the rhythm of the bees themselves. Yes, there should be, actually, Sally, there should 100% be some sort of welfare for bees because it links very closely to our societies.
The other side of that, I don't even know, Sally, but our bees here in Aotearoa, we have to look after them. And I know that sounds weird, like, of course you have to look after them. But before Varroa came in, you really didn't have to. We didn't have Varroa. So the bees, you could just plonk a hive on your farm, only open it, you know, a couple of times a year, if that, just to put honey boxes on and take honey off. And those bees would live very harmoniously in their own little natural, perfectly contained little world, do what they had to do, no problems. Because there were no pests and diseases that were rampant throughout that would kill them without human intervention. Now, varroa has come in. You have to do something, because if you don't, they will die. Talking about the welfare, we should have laws about it, because, like I say, if you don't look after them, they will die. We do not have feral or wild bees out in the paddocks anymore by themselves. Any bee that you see, 99% of them have come from a beehive that someone is looking after. Bees fly. So they can very easily fly into each other's little hives and spread pests and diseases. So if you're a bad beekeeper, you're not looking after your bees, you could very easily be spreading those pests and diseases to someone next door who's trying so hard to keep them alive and breed good bees. But you're right, there's not a law, there's nothing saying that you, Sally, tomorrow could go and buy 1,000 beehives, not know anything about it. There's nothing to track you down or to make sure you're doing it properly. You are supposed to know. That's the bit that annoys me, is the only sort of law that's out there is that you have to register your hives so that the government bee health biosecurity knows where all the hives are in case there is an incursion or like a new pest and disease that comes in, part of the MPI, you know, disease tracking. Loads of people don't even know that. And I'll tell you right now, because that's part of my job, there are loads of beehives out there that are not registered. So that's the thing, there's no background to say you must do this, you must treat them, you must look after them. There's nothing. Which is very, very scary. Not only the bees, but our, you know, pollination and our food and the reasons that we need them and stuff. So, yeah, it's bloody scary.
I think, too, for those smaller operations, people have bees, they're really keen on them, and they want to see how they're doing. They're trying to look after them. During the winter, going into the hive every week or even every second day is not good. The hive cools right down, and it's like taking the roof off your house in the middle of winter to have someone have a look at what's going on. We have artificial heating. They don't. So it takes that hive a long time, as in days, to get the heat back up into it. So you're actually making your bees cold, which doesn't help their survival rates. So during the winter, you're best to look at doing the treatments that you need to do, but keeping that hive closed as much as you can.
One of the things, as president of the Waikato Domestic Bee Association, in our newsletter this month, I made sure that everybody was aware, because hobbyist beekeepers, they're just so excited to be bee owners. They are. But as Sarah said, the days are gone when you could just plonk a beehive in your back garden and hope that it's all going to go swimmingly well. We talk to them about plants for bees, we talk to them about trees for bees, we talk about the fact that they have to treat for varroa mite, they have to make sure their bees have got food. And, you know, we've got beekeepers here in New Zealand that are now, you know, been beekeeping for 50 years. Not every beekeeper does it the same. We try and, you know, keep them motivated to be beekeepers, but also every month it's about giving them another tip about what they ought to be doing. Varroa mite literally is the bane of our life. And so even though they've got a very small cluster in the winter, and then it just decimates the hive. So they come out of spring, they're dead. There is no bees. There is a motivation for us to keep people aware of bees, aware of the welfare of bees, but also to make sure they know how to keep bees correctly. I always say varroa mites like kudus, like head lice, right? I don't know one parent who has not sent their kids to school and they've come home with nits. Bees are the same. They have this really cool thing. It's called floral fidelity, where if there's one flowering source of food, all the hives will go to that one source, and that's where they catch nits. The varroa mite is jumping in the flower and then jumping on a new host. All these little things that we can teach our hobbyist beekeepers are so important, because it keeps our bees alive. We've got 41 native bees in New Zealand. The thing about bees being on Earth, when we had bees, simultaneously we had flowers. They don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. It's the same for bees, actually. When we first started beekeeping, I don't know about you, Sarah, but I could buy a nuke for about $80, $90. You cannot buy a nuke for less than $300 at the moment. And the issue is, can you get them?
I've got people already asking me in advance, and I'm like, don't ask me. I don't even know if I'm going to have any hives of my own to get through to talk about already buying bees in the spring. Jeez Louise, yeah.
There is that issue. And yes, we do try and motivate people to plant. And another little factoid that I love to tell people. So when we brought the bees into New Zealand, we realised they didn't pollinate all the plants that we needed them to pollinate. And Sarah is completely correct. Bumblebees are much better at it. So we have got imported bumblebees as well. We have got one of the rarest bumblebees in the world, Bumblebee subterraneus. Now, our science is so good that you can buy a bumblebee hive, and I'm just about to order some for my daughter's birthday. They only last about 3 months, and then they swarm. It's really cute because when they swarm, the queen goes off with about, I don't know, 5 little worker bees, they're bumbles. Whereas when a hive swarms, it goes off with about 20,000 bees. And we have one of the rarest bumblebees in the world. And we now grow them and export them back to the country from where they came, which is the south of England. And that's, I think, in keeping with what you said, Sarah, and probably with what you said too, Dean, around how growing our own native flora and fauna and protecting it is actually the correct thing to do, because when they brought the bumblebees back to the south of England, they found that it changed the whole ecosystem. So, you know, having wasps kill off our native birds, what the heck? Who knew that a wasp nest could kill a baby bird? I'd never heard of such a thing. It's frightening, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But they eat all the geckos. They're very ferocious and quite the predator. Yes, so yes, we do need to have rights for them.
It's time to start sort of wrapping the conversation up. As we look forward, we've talked quite a lot about some sort of protection or mechanism for protection of bee welfare, and also thinking about people who are going to be having beehives, you know, some sort of more formalized way that they might be offered support or instruction. But what else would you like to see in Aotearoa or globally?
I find it quite strange that, because I've never heard that thing that Dean mentioned about the new houses having the covenant thing to say no bees.
It's not and all find, of them, it's just
some. Oh, no. I had never even heard of that. And I find that kind of irks me, because that kind of links into the people that are very, you know, sort of off the grid, and not even fully off the grid, just trying to have that whole background thing about not relying on the government, growing their own food, making their own bits and pieces. And, you know, and I just kind of think bees should be a part of that. And I find it really, I don't know if I want to use the word offensive, but I just find it really weird that they are saying you can't have bees on your property when they're so required, especially like, say, if you're going to make your own food in your own garden, things like that. But yeah, I just find the laws and the background thoughts of that, yeah, I just find that really harsh. Right. I'm very against that, is what I just want to say there. Yeah.
So I teach Introduction to Beekeeping, and you can do it online. You don't have to be in person. It's an 8-week course. And even if you just come along to learn about bees, not everybody goes on to become a beekeeper, but you learn about what you can do in your small environment to make it much more livable for bees and more sustainable for bees. And it really links in well to sustainable living. And I think that we need to have a stronger link between our pollinators, our native bees, and our introduced managed beehives, as well as the sustainability in not just urban settings, but across the country.
That knowledge base is very lacking. So I do educational bee talks to anyone and everyone. So from kindergarten kids all through their ages, all the way up to retirement villages. And I'm telling you right now, hardly anyone knows that all of the workers are females. I've still got adults believing that the bees make honey for us. They think that's just what it's for. They have no concept of realizing why the bees make honey, because they make it to store so they can have food during the winter. But there's all these little disconnects. And like Dara was saying, the education behind that and just learning just a little bit opened your eyes to they are so important. Yes, we need them. What can I do to, you know, make them stay or make them healthier and not anything harmful? And I just, little tiny bit of education goes a long way, and I think that's very, very important. Yeah.
On that, what are some kind of key tips you would have for anyone listening around how can you make your own environment more bee friendly?
Plants you put in, clovers, all that sort of thing. And if possible, reduce the amount of sprays that you use, or spray at times when the bees aren't flying, like last thing at night. Adjust your clock to suit the bees so you're not killing them off.
I love suggesting for people to have a look when the plants that they plant will be flowering. So obviously most of our plants and things flower in the spring, which is great, which is when bees are doing what they've got to do. But think about today, I don't know about where you are, Sally, but outside here right now is very, very sunny, even though we're in the middle of winter. So as soon as it warms up, the bees fly out to try and find food. And if there's nothing for them to eat, it's just wasted energy. So if we could find things that flowered different times of the year and kind of spread it out so there was always a food source there, I think would be really beneficial for any bees that are in your area. I mean, our birds and all the rest of our flora and fauna that needs things to eat, not those bloody possums, but everything else. If there's always things to eat, it's just helpful for them to get through the winter and not starve to death.
I think I would really like to see the government come on board as well. I would like to see some policy changes around tertiary opportunities. So during COVID, it was fully subsidised to become a beekeeper. But I can tell you now that at the moment, if they don't do something, there's going to be a huge shortage of beekeepers within New Zealand within 2 years. Beekeepers have been on the immigration list for a while, but we have a generation of beekeepers that are now coming to the end of their beekeeping lives. They want to slow down. They want to move on. And so I think we need the government to come on board. We need to see them really look closely at the industry. It's a really important industry. We need them to come on board and start thinking about how to make this a more viable proposition for people. And maybe it's not just about being commercial beekeepers. It's about supporting apiculture industry across the board. I'd like to see those changes.
It's a fairly large economy too, in terms of money. Not only are the bees critical for agriculture, which is a huge export of the countries, but also just thinking about manuka honey solely, but that's quite a New Zealand product.
It's a niche product.
Economic value attached to that as a product.
So at the moment, there's quite a lot of people trying to buy New Zealand honey and there's none available. So we may have had a glut of honey, but I think those days are gone. If you go onto any of the commercial sites, we've got foreigners looking for honey products and there just isn't any. You know, why are they not supporting New Zealand beekeepers and supporting the New Zealand economy? I feel like things like offering some sort of incentives, we do need more government support. We need to make sure that our bees are disease-free. We need to make sure people are registering their hives. But we also need to know that if they are being abandoned, who's going to them? Who's going to look after those hives? Because actually, Sarah's right. We've had 3 people in the last 6 weeks say, this is a farmer. He's got like 30 hives on his property. The beekeeper hasn't been there for ages. He said, you know, what can I do? As a person working in the law school, I would first caution you about thinking they are abandoned. But secondly, you need to contact the beekeeper. And if that doesn't work, contact the agency. Because actually, you know, we've got hobbyist beekeepers and they were like, oh, we'll go and get them. Actually, it's trespass and it could be theft. So now the sort of legal nightmare. And you know, when you have got abandoned hives and you don't know what you're getting. You don't know if they've got disease.
Yeah, I tell all the hobbyists to just steer clear. But
yeah, because if you get a small little hive, it's about 350 online at the moment. If you get a full hive, you're looking at about $500. That is a significant investment. And when did bees become that expensive? When they became rarer and scarcer to find.
Final words as we wrap up.
Thank you very much for having us. I think this is a really important discussion. We need to raise the awareness of bees and bee welfare. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, Sally. I'll just now say I would love to point out the little bit about just a little bit of education goes a long way. So, yeah, just do a little Google, learn something new about bees, and hopefully, yeah, keep them a bit healthier and happier in your own environment, even if you don't have them.
If you're interested in bees, even if you don't have a hive, look for a local club in your area and join it, because they're always out for new members, and you can find a lot of information and give you access to stuff that you don't know is available. So well worth the joining fee.
Yeah, it's cheap as chips too, I've got to say. it's like $25 a year.
Well, thank you all so much. As somebody who is quite new to all of this, I've learned an awful lot. You've painted quite a dire picture, but I think that education piece particularly around if everyone takes on a wee bit of responsibility, takes that responsibility just to start to learn a bit more, hopefully there can be a bit of a turnaround. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.